Tuba Fir Story. Today I am talking to Verity Dryden about the psychology of Anne Boleyn between the years 1526 and 1536. You may know Verity best as the Tudor Book on Instagram. She is currently writing about Anne Boleyn and the responses Anne might have had to events around Anne at the time. Hello, Verity. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Jess. I've been really excited to join your podcast. I do listen to it and it is fantastic. So thank you very much for having me as a guest.
No, it's my absolute pleasure. I'm glad to hear you listen to the podcast. So today we are discussing Anne Boleyn and the trauma responses to events surrounding her from 1526 to 1536.
Yes.
But I thought first we could talk a little bit about you.
Okay.
So firstly, when did you become interested in Tudor history?
I know a lot of the audience are going to go, oh no, but I remember I was about 12 years old and my mum and her best friend wanted to go and see the adaptation of The Other Boleyn Girl with Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson playing Mary and Anne. So I was taken to see that in the cinema. I really didn't want to go. It was, in my eyes, as a 12-year-old, it was a stuffy costume drama. But I came out completely in love with the Tudors. And for me, that Natalie Portman is Anne.
Okay. That's interesting. I've not heard that a lot of people don't like Natalie Portman's Anne, do they? It's a trail that's not as popular.
No, I think she's quite sexy as Anne, and I feel like Anne was quite sexy, so I feel she hits the nail on the head for me.
Oh, okay, that's a new one. So would you say that is what drew you to Tudor history as well? Like that film is what kicked it off?
Yeah, I came out just wanting to know more. It's like something out of Grimm's fairy tale, really, isn't it? A queen being beheaded. So it was just, that was it. I was off down the rabbit hole after that.
Why is Anne Boleyn fascinating to you?
For me, I think Anne, she refused to be sort of moulded into a shape that she wasn't. She was very much herself. She was very honest to herself. She was authentic. And I personally feel that she's been given quite a bad rep throughout history. And obviously only now we are starting to overturn that view and fight her corner, or as Anne would say, meddle of her cause. But I think I've got a lot of respect for the fact that she was quite independent and she knew her own mind. And of course, she was very fashionable.
No, I agree. I think, as you say, Anne is so authentic. You know, there isn't a filter with Anne.
Yeah.
She is who she is.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like her anyway. And I know some people, you either you love the Anne or you hate her. Like, she is a bit Marmite-y for some people.
It is, but I feel even when she became queen, if you look at the contrast of Catherine of Aragon, Catherine was raised to be queen. She knew what was expected of her and Anne wasn't. And even with the pressures of queenship, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on in regards to how that could affect somebody's mental state, and still refuse to be nothing other than her authentic self.
No, I agree. I completely agree. So on Instagram, you're known as the Tudor Book, and you are currently writing a book on Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
So what made you go for the angle you have on Anne Boleyn? And do you want to talk about what you're specifically writing about in relation to Anne Boleyn?
Yeah, so I think mental health and mental well-being has sort of become its own runaway train recently in the last decade, and it's taken on a life of its own, which I think is really important, because when we talk about mental well-being and we talk about being kind to other people, we really need to get to grips and make it the norm of showing other people compassion, because trauma is something everybody's going to go through, something adverse in their lifetime. Everybody's going to have hardships and adversity, but trauma is so common, and to look at Anne through a trauma-informed lens is in my own way giving Anne a little bit of compassion. And I feel as well, if you can empathize with the situation and you can understand it through a mental health lens, you can empathize with Anne a little bit more, because obviously in modern day reality, none of us are going to get locked in the Tower of London by our husband. None of us are going to get our head cut off in a public execution. So she's so far removed from the reality of modern day audience that you can struggle to relate to her in those ways. But I feel if we look at it through the lens of mental well-being, it can help audiences feel Anne's a little bit more tangible in some ways, I think.
No, sorry. Yeah, I think because they were obviously 400, 500 years ago, I think people seem to forget they were human and they were people.
Yeah, absolutely. We look at history a lot through dates, facts, times. She said this, he did that. And actually, to put a bit of an emotional spin on it, we can then relate to them a little bit more. Because I know I certainly can't relate to Henry VIII on a lot of things. I'm not a king, I'm not a tyrant. But if you look at it through the mental health lens, we can maybe understand their actions in a way that we maybe previously have ignored, or not even so much ignored, but have previously sort of not recognised.
No, I agree. I think Henry VIII is kind of, obviously he's a very complex figure, but he wasn't treated for a long time as complex as he should be.
Absolutely. And when you look at the decade of sort of Anne Boleyn's rise and the decade of her fall, nobody gets out of this unscathed. Thomas Cromwell, to some extent, is a victim of trauma. And again, we'll talk about that later on. Henry himself is a victim of trauma. You know, from the loss of his mother very early on, that is an adverse childhood trauma. And then you look at, he's the most powerful man in England, yet everybody's whispering in his ear and trying to manipulate them for their own means. So, no, Mary the First, she's certainly traumatised from what goes on. Catherine of Aragon, nobody seems to get out of this unscathed. And of course, Anne is the ultimate victim. Her and George unfortunately lose their lives alongside the other men Anne was accused with. But nobody gets out of this without a mark on them.
Yeah, no, I agree. So on to today's topic. So we're going right from 1526 up until Anne's execution in 1536. So for context, 1526 is when Henry starts to court Anne, and we know Anne goes back to Hever. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about the fact when the king does start showing affection and attention towards Anne, her response is to go back home and not return to court.
Yeah, so just before we get into that, I just want to stress, I am not a medical professional here. I'm not in any way trying to diagnose Anne retroactively. However, I have been working with somebody who's a British Association registered counsellor. Oh God, if she's listening, I hope I've said that correctly. But I have been working with somebody who is a trauma-informed counsellor to look over this. So when we get to 1526 and Henry starts to court Anne and Anne hides from Hever, I would see that as Anne feeling a little bit trapped. When you look at people who are victims of trauma, there seems to be one common and strong theme with that, and that is control. And Hever Castle is somewhere that offers Anne a sense of safety and a sense of control. She can control her surroundings to some extent because she's a member of the household, she's a member of the noble family that resides at Hever. But for me, it's a feeling that she's feeling a little bit trapped, so she's withdrawn from Henry. And of course, she's seen all of Henry's other mistresses discarded, one of them being her own sister, who's now discarded. I think Mary gets a pension of £100 a year, which is an absolute pittance to live on. She's got, I think by this point, no, William Carey hasn't died of the sweating sickness. That's in 1528, isn't it? So Mary, her sister's being ruined, and Anne does not want that for herself. So I believe in the beginning, actually, Anne wasn't as interested in Henry. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a feeling of being trapped there. So I feel Anne was probably moving away from. So when you look at the scale of trauma, you've got singular events like an act of God, which would be a lightning strike on your home. You can't control where lightning hits. And then you've got the other extreme end, which is adverse childhood experiences. And then you've got everything sort of scattered in the middle. And you can be traumatized from one singular incident, like an act of God, or you can have incidences that are reoccurring over a prolonged period of time, such as Henry and Anne's relationship. It was a really stressful decade. So I think Anne was probably under chronic stress from around 1526 onwards.
No, I agree. I think 1526 is kind of, obviously it's the beginning of Anne and Henry's relationship, but it's also when, by 1527, when we know that Anne does accept Henry's proposal, she's now in the public eye completely.
Yeah. So when again, we are going to mention control a lot through this. When you go into the public eye, a lot of things leave your control, they leave your domain, because you cannot control what the people say about you. You cannot control what the people think about you. And of course, I think, is it George Throckmorton in 1532? We have a letter from him who he asks Henry about Mary and their mother, Elizabeth Boleyn, and Henry replies with, never with the mother. So you've got now rumours swirling about Anne's nearest and dearest as well, publicly defaming her sister and potentially a mother as a whore. Anne is publicly defamed as a whore. So what is she? The scandal of Christendom, the whore of Christendom. So you've got all this gossip. And if this was happening on a much smaller scale today, within an office setting or within a social setting, we'd probably call it bullying. But because it's on such a vast, uncontrollable stage, it's out within the public domain. And it's not like today where Anne can just pop on live on national television and dispel any of the rumours. She's unable to do that. So she's probably realising at this point that the only person between her and complete danger is, in fact, Henry. So again, that fear centre in the brain, the amygdala, is probably, it's going off like a smoke alarm. There's a lot of animosity now building at court, because obviously you've got factions starting to form between Catherine of Aragon's loyal servants and the people who are actually wanting a little bit of change, which is Anne Boleyn's faction. But you'll not know foe from friend when you turn your head.
Yeah. By 1528, we know it's public knowledge that Anne is Henry's mistress, and I've done that in air quotes because it's believed Anne and Henry never officially slept together until 1532. He was, would you say, companion almost?
Yeah. I mean, Anne was more than the match of Henry intellectually, and that is something that probably puts Anne above the rest of her female courtiers. She was given an education not afforded to the rest of the English ladies. And Lancelot de Carles actually writes she was more French than English. I think in his poem about the life of her, you would not know her from a French woman. So she's been given this fantastic European education. And isn't it at this point Henry starts to give her powers in regards to, he asks for her opinion on matters of state, he asks for her opinion on politics. So again, it comes back to this control. There's sort of a definition of the relationship being laid out here. Anne's got the upper hand as mistress, and they're falling into their roles within this companionship, because yes, although they are companions, and as far as we are aware, they aren't doing anything in the bedroom, there's still a lot of lust, there's a lot of tension there. So Henry is allowing Anne to take charge. So Anne, to some extent, is in control here. She's able to control her surroundings, and by her surroundings, Henry.
Would you say that when it is more in the public eye, when Anne is known as Henry's mistress, Do we know from any records that do survive how Anne reacted to being in the public eye so much?
Top of my head, I know she was incredibly frightened with the Durham mob when she had to flee York Place. And I think we have some records from not how Anne felt, but we have certainly have records from her coronation that people weren't exactly happy. There was no sort of public sort of, it wasn't a joyous occasion, it wasn't a festival. And I think that would directly sort of feed into a feeling of fear for Anne. She hadn't won over the people like she expected to. And I think if, you know, we don't have the contemporary sources directly from Anne to my knowledge, but we do have Durham Place and the fact that Anne had to flee Durham House or Durham Place because there was a mob coming for her. I think we could probably read between the lines and again understand that probably sheer terror flooded Anne's senses at that point because the public aren't reacting well to her, that there's an armed mob coming to get this woman. So I would probably put a large amount of money down on a bet to say that she was probably absolutely terrified.
No, I agree. I think Anne was under an incredible amount of pressure because she wasn't well received for the attention of Henry VIII. And we know by 1529 when Cardinal Campeggio comes to England to review the case of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, there is so much tension, there's so much pressure. You know, Henry and Anne have been together for what we know is either 2 to 3 years by this point. And if this court doesn't go well, there's no winner for Anne, is there?
It's a stalemate. So the pressure is piling on. So you've got all these different areas of pressure coming down onto Henry and Anne because publicly she's being defamed as a whore. And the country supports Catherine of Aragon. Catherine of Aragon's been the queen now for what, 17 years? I want to say 17, yeah. around 17 years. So when we get to the legatine court, and I feel as well that the entire eyes of Europe have now turned to Anne. She's on the political world stage. But we know Anne was incredibly loyal to her family. We know Anne was incredibly loyal to her friends. We know she absolutely adored her brother George. And I don't feel for one moment, I think Anne was not without a conscience. And I think Anne probably may have felt a degree of shame or guilt over subjecting Catherine of Aragon to what she did, to publicly embarrass that woman on such a broad, it was an international scale. It was the scandal of Europe. I think Anne probably had feelings of shame, feelings of guilt, and probably a lot of anxiety around what was happening within the legatine court. And then, of course, Catherine of Aragon, very astute woman, sort of pulled the Uno Reverso card and said, absolutely not, I'm going to refer this to the papal authority. So they'd sort of been top-trumped by Catherine at the final hour of that. And then, of course, that then drags it out again for another number of years. So there's a lot of pressure there. They've got the pressure that they want to be married. Anne has promised Henry a son, so the time's ticking with that. Henry wants his son. Henry wants to be rid of Catherine of Aragon. But then if he gets rid of Catherine of Aragon, he knows that there's a threat of war. It's imagine a piece of cotton. It's a complete knot. There's no way to untangle this cleanly.
Yeah, I think by 1529 as well, there was kind of no going back. I know in Europe they kind of thought, oh, he can just go back to Catherine. I don't think it was as simple as that because that would have made Henry look ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Anne would have looked ridiculous. Cardinal Wolsey would have looked ridiculous. I think, again, it was a stalemate, as you say, and there was no winner at this point.
Absolutely is no winner. So if Anne did have any feelings of guilt, shame, I think we certainly know that Henry had feelings of guilt and of shame, especially when Catherine of Aragon gave him the little speech at the court. Feel there were things now in motion that could not be undone. So again, there might have been this feeling of, right, well, this is the only way forward now. So the Anne might again have had feelings of being trapped alongside that guilt, that shame, and that anxiety. I'm sure she managed to swallow them down. You know, I'm not for one minute saying Anne totally regretted her decision, but I'm saying she was a human being, and I think at some point her conscience will have got on top of her, and she will have felt a degree of guilt for subjecting Catherine to what she did.
Yeah. Would you say when the Legatine court failed, and this kind of brings on the downfall of Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, and we think Anne had quite a big part to play in this downfall, would you say that's a result of what was going on and she wanted to punish someone?
It potentially could be when you're irritable and you are in the... So when you're in a fight or flight zone, so when you're in green, when you're nice and calm, so that's imagine it's like the week before Christmas, you've got fresh gin jams on, the fire's on, you've got nice hot chocolate, the lights thing. It's all lovely and cosy in your living room, you're watching your favourite Christmas film, that's the green zone, you're nice and calm, you know, you're regulated, your emotions are regulated. When you go into the amber zone, your body is basically reacting. So lightning strikes your home, right? Every time you then smell smoke, after that, the amygdala in your brain could be triggered to think, oh my God, something's burning. So you go back into that fight or flight zone. So if you are constantly in a state of dysregulation and your body is constantly remembering that you are under some sort of imminent threat, perceived or real, you can lash out. You can become very snappy. You can become very irritable. And could have potentially lashed out at Wolsey, looking for somebody to pin the blame on in that moment. But I do also feel that Anne in this moment a little bit calculated as well. I think she wants rid of Wolsey. I think Wolsey and her aren't each other's biggest fan. And I think, again, it's a case of a bit like Cromwell or Anne, it's me or you, one of us has got to go, there's not enough room in this bed for me, you and the king, so one of us is going to have to move. And I think Anne and Henry, in his desperation for Anne, are convinced to get rid of Wolsey, but in doing that, Anne creates a lifelong enemy in Thomas Cromwell.
Yes, no, I agree. I think Wolf Hall, Thomas Cromwell is very accurate. I know that's kind of going out of it a bit, but how he sees Anne and how her getting rid of Wolsey makes an enemy of him because she's drew that line.
Source that states that Cromwell was viewed to be crying after something had happened to the cardinal. So, and Cromwell goes down to try and argue in defence of the cardinal because they come from similar backgrounds, don't they? One is the son of a butcher, and Cromwell is the son of a blacksmith.
Yes.
Yes. So so Cromwell's lost his employer. He's lost his livelihood. In one fell swoop, Anne has managed to not only destroy Wolsey, but she's also nearly destroyed Cromwell. Obviously, Cromwell manages to come back from that into the king's employ, but in that moment, Cromwell nearly lost everything, but he also loses somebody who is probably a very good friend and close companion to him. So I think there's a little case of revenge there later on in 1536, but we'll get to that.
Sorry, my dog was licking. Sorry.
Don't worry about it.
Would you say from 1530, Anne became a lot more paranoid and irrational?
Yes. Yes. Because there's building pressure here. There's pressure now mounting. So 1530, Cardinal Wolsey has died. There's a renewed sense of hope for Henry and Anne in their relationship with the arrival of Thomas Cromwell at court. But there's more and more public pressure building because people don't want to start. People are worried about the outcome of Catherine of Aragon. Of course, there is worry about the support for Mary the First. Anne knows that she's in, even though she's technically the most powerful woman in England, the only person standing between her, I think I said this earlier, is Henry. The only person who's standing between her and absolute destruction is Henry. And that has got to take a mental toll on somebody. To be constantly looking over your shoulder is no way to live. That would induce fear. That would induce a lot of cortisol production. And I imagine she wasn't sleeping great either. Cortisol spikes, it affects your sleep, it affects your heart rate. When you're stressed as well, you can sit with your shoulders hunched up. Blood rushes away from your internal organs to go to your extremities, so you can either run or you can punch something. So you fight or flight all the time. So if you're constantly living in that state, you'd be very, very exhausted all of the time.
Yeah. I can't remember who said at the time, and you might remember, that in 1535, or early 1536, Anne is reported to have been looking a bit haggard and old.
Yes, who says that? Is it a foreign diplomat?
I think so.
Don't think it's Eustace Chapuis. There is a foreign diplomat who says she looks haggard. However, then when you get to the day of her execution, the Queen never looked so beautiful by Lancelot de Carle. So we've got two really conflicting views here about the Queen in her final few months. And I will get to that later on, because I think what Lancelot de Carle writes is actually something to do with the red zone. And I think Anne's gone into complete collapse there, which can produce a sort of glazed, serene look. And I think that's what they're talking about at her execution. I think she's just thought, this is it, there's no saving me, I'm done for. So I think she allows herself to enter a state of collapse. But yes, someone does talk about being haggard, as if the Queen, it's something to do with the Queen looking a lot older than she is.
Yes, I remembered it as she was talking. I was like, someone says something in the late mid-1530s about Anne's appearance.
Being a lot older than she is. And I think that is the symptom of extreme chronic stress. And you've got to think, by the mid-30s, Anne's been living in probably what is chronic stress for nearly a decade now. That has got to take its toll on you as a person.
In 1531, we know Catherine of Aragon is banished from court. Henry has taken that step to remove Catherine from the marriage. And the title of Supreme Head is created for Henry. So we know by this point he is kind of giving up on the Catholic faith a bit, and he's breaking from Rome. Do you think Anne saw this as a really positive thing? Or do you think she was still stressed?
I think she was still stressed. But again, it comes down to a sense of control. It allows the ball to prevent the proverbial ball to go back into Henry and Anne's proverbial court. The Pope's never going to give Henry his annulment. He's never going to allow him to separate from Catherine of Aragon. So in doing that, Henry can get what he wants. Anne can get what they want. But in breaking with the papal authority and in separating with Rome, suddenly a lot of people who were steadfast supporters of Anne and Henry, like the Duke of Norfolk, Anne's uncle, suddenly think, oh, absolutely not. This is the Catholic Church. This is an institution. So this, when I said earlier, a lot of people, nobody gets out of this unscathed. It can be traumatic to have an institution and that routine, because Anne's Book of Hours, a book that would literally mark out your day and how to fill it with prayer and religious offerings. If you rip that sort of institution away from somebody, that can be very upsetting, and that can be very stressful in and of itself. So it's this defiant attempt at regaining control. Henry's not getting what he wants, Anne's not getting what she wants. So that it's an attempt to take control. But in doing that, in that attempt of taking control, they're also losing a lot of supporters.
Yes, I think, as you say, there is so much damage and casualties in Henry and Anne's relationship. And it wasn't just Henry and Anne who, you know, had the... It wasn't them just experiencing the relationship. The whole country and the European court felt the after effects of their relationship.
Absolutely. Anne and Henry's marriage have changed England forever. You know, now the monarchy is still the head of state, the head of the church. What Anne and Henry achieved and did has changed the tapestry of England forever.
No, you're completely right. And it's mad. I find this insane. I don't know if you do, but by time James the Sixth is king, so 40, 60, 80 years later, it's actually illegal to be Catholic.
Yeah, it's a complete sort of 180 from, you know, Henry used to be the defender of the faith, and then five monarchs later, we've done a complete... I think I talk about this in my book, and I think in the space of 300 years, we change our religion something like 31 times. Don't quote me on that. I've got the fact in my book, and I've got the numbers and everything to back it up. But I think by the time Oliver Cromwell comes around, we change religions. Quite no, not Oliver Cromwell. After Oliver Cromwell, Oliver, we've changed religions a number of times in this country since Henry VIII.
No, we have, and I find that really interesting that him making that change to marry Anne Boleyn. And by the time we get to Victoria, you can't marry a Catholic.
it's own runaway train. It's an avalanche. It just snowballs out of control. Religious reform. You know, you look at Mary. Mary comes back in with Catholic. Then Elizabeth comes back in with Protestant. So you've got Protestant, Catholic, Protestant, and suddenly it's completely illegal to be Catholic. And this... It absolutely snowballs out of control here with Henry entitling himself the head of the church.
In 1532, we start to see positive changes for Anne. On September the 1st, 1532, Anne is made Marquess of Pembroke. Mm-hmm. And she and Henry also go to Calais to meet Francis I, who she would have known very well, seeing as she grew up in France for 7 years. And there's also a rumour that they possibly got married in November 1532. Maybe not, most likely January, but obviously it's contested. Do you think Anne did see this as a good thing and, you know, she should enjoy it? Or do you think she thought, now I have to produce the son, or I am going to go the same way?
See, I've always said this. The minute Henry is created the head of state and he's sort of supreme head of the church, that is a nail in Anne's coffin. That is the first sort of chip away at Anne, because it's given an absolute monarch absolute authority to do whatever he likes, come hell or high water. So when we get to 1532 and Anne is made Marquess of Pembroke, it's almost a defiant show that it's like her motto, grudge those who grudge it. It's like a defiant show of, this is how it's going to be and you will accept it. They're ennobling her, they're making it. Didn't she become one of the most rich landowners in England? It's almost another attempt at total dominion over separating factions at court. And by the time they get to, actually, just before we get to that, on Easter Sunday, 1532, a public sermon is preached where Henry is warned he would lose power over the kingdom. And this public sermon sort of indirectly insinuates that Anne is like a Jezebel, a morally unrestrained woman. So although Anne is gaining more and more power, again, she's acutely aware in the background that the only thing that stands between her and utter destruction is Henry. So she has to keep Henry in her good books. So, although, yes, outwardly, it's all moving in her favour. She's been ennobled as the Marquess of Pembroke. You know, she's causing such a stir. People are preaching public sermons about her. By the time we get to November and we go to Calais, Marguerite of Navarre, the woman who helped shape Anne's opinions on religious reform, helped Anne through some of her most formative years, and can, to some extent, be probably responsible for the Anne Boleyn that we know, this very French-looking and French-acting woman, she rejects Anne. She refuses to greet her at Calais. And that must have been such a personal hurt for Anne, because this is a woman who has raised Anne to some extent. Because depending on what year you go off Anne's born, she's only a young teenager or a very young woman in the most formative years of her life when she meets Margaret of Navarre. And then suddenly there's this feeling of rejection and abandonment by a woman who had practically raised her and had her in her wardship.
No, I agree. I think it's such a personal blow. And Anne would have felt that very much. She thought going to France would be a good thing. And the noble women refusing to go is a blow.
Yeah, so you've got this Anne's who was it? Is it the French ambassador says we've now got an ambassador for France in the UK with Anne Boleyn being back in the English court. You know, we've got somebody who's basically singing all of France's praises. So Anne going back somewhere again, she's probably really looking forward to going to Calais. To Anne, this is her home. You know, Anne is very French. She's very French in the culture and the way she presents herself, so the way she looks, her French fashions. But she's rejected by somewhere that she views is ultimately her home. So the woman who helped Anne shape her worldview has now rejected her. So yet again, that comes down to that is another traumatic incident. And of course, I don't think Margaret of Navarre rejected her for complete and utter personal reasons. I think it was probably to keep the eyes of the Spanish Emperor, Catherine of Aragon's nephew, off her. But still, that is a very personal hurt for Anne, that Anne, and it's public as well.
Yeah.
It's not Margaret pulling her into a quiet corner and saying, what on earth are you doing? It's a public snub in front of both courts.
No, I agree. I think it can't have been nice for Anne to experience that. By 1533, January 1533, I should specify, Anne is married to Henry. And we believe she is pregnant at this time with the future Elizabeth I. 1533 is a big year for Anne. It's the coronation for her in June 1533. It's the birth of Elizabeth in September of that year. And the court knows she is Queen of England now. And that is how it's going to be. How do you think this turn of events was for Anne?
It's her greatest triumph on the face of it, isn't it? It's her greatest triumph. She is finally Queen of England. And she's pregnant. She's 6 months pregnant by the time of her coronation. She's visibly showing she has a swollen belly. But Anne's coronation is not broadly accepted by the public. It isn't a joyous occasion. And but again, it's a very lavish occasion, isn't it? Anne is actually crowned, she's actually seated upon Edward the Confessor's throne. So it's a defiant show of Anne is ennobled. She is your queen. You will accept her. Again, it comes back down to control, and it's sort of a really stubborn show by Henry that you will accept her. This is your rightful monarch. She is my rightful wife. So it's just a big show. So although, yes, on the surface, Anne has won, she hasn't really, because nobody's celebrating with her, that the public aren't in vast agreement with Anne.
No, I agree.
And, of course, by the time The Birth of Elizabeth I comes around, it's a girl.
Yeah, I think, as you say, on the surface, it's a really good moment for Anne. And it shows that, yes, she's achieved everything she wants. But she also knows if the baby she was carrying at the coronation wasn't a boy or it was a stillbirth, whatever the outcome of the pregnancy was, if it wasn't a boy, that meant she had less time to prove herself.
Yeah. So Anne's queenship is rocked. The foundations of her queenship are rocked only a number of months, only I think 3 or 4 months into her role as Henry's wife and queen. And although Anne is very maternal and very proud of Elizabeth, you know, she displays her on a velvet cushion underneath the canopy of a state. Again, it's like this almost defiant show of, yes, she's a girl, but I can have healthy children. I will have a boy. And Elizabeth is now your rightful heir. It's almost, it's defiant. Again, it's this sort of attempt at complete control. And also, Anne has promised Henry a boy and she's not delivered on that promise. So to some extent, once Anne's churched and she's back out in public with the little Elizabeth on her hip, she's got egg on her face to some extent. Although, yes, nobody would probably dare say it to her face, but she hasn't given Henry a boy. So there may have also been feelings of guilt for wanting Elizabeth to have been a boy, or shame, potentially, because she's put a lot of stock has been put in this pregnancy, and it's a girl. It's the wrong gender. Of course, we know Elizabeth went on to be probably our most successful monarch, but in that moment, who was to know what that little girl would do when she was grown? Henry didn't foresee her ruling England as the last of the Tudor dynasty. Neither Anne probably didn't foresee that. Nobody could really, but there's a lot to be put on the birth of Elizabeth. I think it's one of the greatest moments in her career, if you look through hindsight, of what Elizabeth achieved as Henry and Anne's daughter. But also, the fear must have been immense if she couldn't conceive a boy and couldn't conceive one quickly.
No, I agree. It's kind of like clocks ticking. She saw what happened to Catherine. She knows probable outcome would happen to her. And we know by 1534, not just in England, abroad, there are also now pressures coming in because Henry has made this drastic decision. Mm-hmm. And Anne knows that she needs to give him a son to kind of prove that all of this was worth it.
Well, he's Henry, in creating his own title and breaking with Rome, is at this point alienated us politically from the rest of Europe to some extent. So he needs a boy to say, look, I was right all along. Look, God does smile upon my new marriage. I am right. So, but obviously that's not happened.
No.
There's egg on their face.
In 1534, we know that John Fisher and Thomas More, some of Henry's oldest advisors and friends, mm-hmm. are arrested. And we know Anne is blamed for this. The court blame her for this. The country and abroad blame her for this. How do you think Anne reacted and felt towards this?
I think she'll have been frightened. There's a brutal execution of a God-fearing man here, and the public look at John Fisher, through the sort of the draw similarities are between, I believe, between him and John the Baptist, who was executed by King Herod for talking against marrying his brother's widow. So I think there's feelings of fear again here building, because you've got the Nun of Kent is also executed. But interestingly, Henry, like the Nun of Kent, while their views align, but the minute she starts saying, oh, no, 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 your marriage with Anne is not good enough, that's when things obviously go wrong for her. And I think Anne will have been under a lot of pressure again, because this public hatred towards her is building. She hasn't given the king a son. She doesn't have the might of a foreign nation behind her like Catherine of Aragon did. She's not actually French, so therefore she doesn't completely have French backing. She's not a French princess. So there's stress very much building here. And she must have been so... underneath the surface, there must have been heart palpitations, probably sleepless nights. Very snappy. We know Anne starts to get quite irritable. Here we know she snaps publicly at Henry a few times. And I think this is probably because she's in extreme fight or flight mode. She's probably scanning her surroundings constantly for danger, because she can't catch a break. So if you look at it through that lens, she'll have been traumatised.
No, I agree. I think it was a very emotional and traumatic time. And by 1535, we know that Henry VIII is losing interest in Anne. Anne has possibly had a second miscarriage by 1535. And we also know it's the brutal execution of the Carthusian monks, which caused outrage. And Henry VIII also executes Thomas More and John Fisher. And we know Anne is blamed for this. And we also know Henry starts to kind of get blamed for this a little bit as well, when he decides to execute his friends. And they go on progress in 1535 to run away, essentially, from the havoc that's in London. Do you think Anne knew that the game was starting to finish?
Absolutely, because by the time we get to the back end of 1535, I think Eustace Chapuis writes that the king now shrinks away from his wife in private and has not said more than 10 words to the concubine in recent months. It's horrible, that, isn't it, that he refers to her as the concubine. So Anne, again, there's that sense of danger. Nothing's well in a marriage, so that one person who stands between her and complete destruction is now starting to become really cold. And when your amygdala is going off, that lovely little fear centre in your brain, it's very primitive. It's what allowed us to run away from woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers, right? So it's very primitive. So you can't reason with it. You cannot sit down. Do you know when your mind's racing? You can't have a logical conversation with an amygdala. It is very primitive. It is there to alert you to danger. So it is there. It helps us sort of pick out facial features. Obviously, a lot of how we communicate is through smiles, eyes, soft eyes. So when Henry's is shrinking away from her in private, he's barely speaking to her. Her amygdala will have been going off, not behind closed doors. Things aren't well, but in public, neither of them are going to admit that they've made a bad decision, and that they have to stand fast to the course. So behind closed doors, Anne will probably be very much in the amber zone, fight or flight. She'll have been very anxious, very stressed, aware that it's all starting to fall apart. Really, I think it starts to fall apart before 1536, because obviously she keeps miscarrying. And we've previously seen Henry quickly fell out of love and developed what I would say is a complete disdain for Catherine of Aragon because of her miscarriages, sadly.
No, I agree. I think, as you say, the downfall of Anne started before 1536. And we know towards the end of 1535, beginning of 1536, Anne is pregnant once again. And we know coming into January 1536, Catherine of Aragon dies. So Anne is kind of the uncontested queen officially. But because Catherine of Aragon has died, people are saying, well, Henry's free to marry again, because they don't believe that he was truly married to Anne.
Yes, so think for Anne, Catherine of Aragon is like a knife edge for Anne, because while she's alive, people are going to say Catherine of Aragon's the real queen, but there's also the threat of war with Spain. But when Catherine of Aragon, Henry's not going to put Anne to one side while Catherine of Aragon's still alive, because the Pope would say, right, we'll take her back then. And he doesn't want Catherine of Aragon. He wants a young wife who can give him a child. So there's this knife edge, because Catherine of Aragon is also, ironically, one of the barriers keeping Anne safe while Catherine's alive. So then when Catherine dies, yes, she's finally uncontested queen. But as you say, oh, we can put Anne aside now. You can marry again in the eyes of the Catholic Church. You're a widower now, Henry. So it's a knife edge again. And then, of course, she has a miscarriage where Eustace Chapuys states she has miscarried of her saviour, because the pregnancy is reportedly far enough along that it is to be a boy. And again, these constant miscarriages, that's stressful. That's heartbreaking. Not just as Anne for her career in regards to the fact she needs a male heir, but it's heartbreaking for the fact that she's a mother and she's clearly very maternal in the way she lavishly spends on Elizabeth. She's unable to give Elizabeth physical affection with her Elizabeth being brought up at Hatfield House, so she lavishly spends on Elizabeth. So clearly we've got a very maternal figure here who is now struggling to carry a child to term. That must have been heartbreaking. So that grief cycle will have been absolutely awful and will have taken its toll on her physical health as well as her mental and emotional well-being.
No, I agree. I think when we focus on the downfall of Anne Boleyn, it is purely on her career and not as the woman she was and the mother she was to Elizabeth. And we know that when Anne does miscarry for the final time, Henry becomes very cold and distant towards her. And he abandons her as soon as she miscarries. He goes to Greenwich. Yeah. And we know this is also the rise of Jane Seymour. And I don't know how you see it. And obviously, I'm going to ask you how you see it. Do you see this as an escalation of Anne's mental health? Because I think she goes on a spiral.
Absolutely. So we know Anne's got a sharp temper. We know Anne's very quick-witted. She can have quite the barbed tongue at the best of times. I mean, I certainly know I wouldn't want to get into a war of words with her, because she's very quick-witted. But we know that she actually she has a physical altercation with Jane.
Mm.
She's so irritable, and she must have been frightened out of her wits. She knows what's happening. She hasn't got the might of the Spanish Empire backing her, as I mentioned earlier. She hasn't got a foreign nation to protect her. And she actually attacks Jane. That's unheard of. And she attacks Jane so violently that she apparently injures her at the palm of her own hand in doing so, when she rips the locket from around Jane's neck. And also, if she did actually love Henry, if she did have any sense of romantic love for Henry, imagine walking in, you've seen somebody sat on your husband's knee. My heart broke when I saw you loved another.
Mm.
It's heartbreaking, and she'll have known that the end is near. There'll have been this sense of, that's it. It's over. But nothing was happening about it. So again, it's this sense of apprehension, this sense of anxiety of, okay, well, I'm still queen. I've not been arrested, or I've not been summoned to a court for divorce. but he's clearly got another mistress. So there might have also been this potential sense of maybe after a few months with Jane Seymour, he'll come back to me and we'll be well again. Because somebody states that they fought like cat and dog, but they always had ardent reunions.
Yes.
They always had very amorous reunions. So that there was clearly, if there wasn't a romantic love, there was clearly lust and a deep mutual respect for each other, I think. But I think this is, and we'd certainly see her mental health start to spiral. So I think she was a very intelligent woman, and I think she will have known that everything was starting to slip away from her. And again, there's this sense of there's this loss of control. She can't control her ladies in waiting. Jane Seymour's got no respect for her. She can't control her husband. He's strained from the marital bed. She can't control her pregnancies. She can't control her kingdom. People do not respect her as queen. So there's this complete lack of control around her. And I think one of the ways that we see Anne gain control is a lavish spending on Elizabeth.
Mm.
It's one way to have control over something. To that instant where she sends the cap back and forth, Elizabeth's little velvet cap. I think she sends it back to the tailors 4 or 5 times.
She has to have it perfect.
Perfect. And that is an example of she's trying to have control over something.
No, I agree. By May 1536, well, the 2nd of May 1536, Anne is arrested for adultery. Well, at that point, treason. She doesn't actually know what crimes she has committed until a later date. And I thought, did you want to talk a little bit about Anne's time in the Tower and how she kind of came to accept the fact she was going to die?
Yeah, so when Anne's in the Tower, we sort of have reports from Sir William Kingston's letters to Thomas Cromwell and some reports from Eustace Chapuis, don't we, that she seems to flip between hysteria and total calmness. And yeah. I think Anne is on the verge of entering the red zone here. So again, we were talking about earlier, you've got that green zone, you're lovely and calm. It's the week before Christmas, you're dead chill. Then you've got the amber zone, you're really irritated, things getting on top of you. It's a straw that breaks the camel's back. Red is complete collapse. Red is you are so stressed, your brain almost shuts down to protect itself. And I think Anne is nearing a state of collapse here. Do you know when she says to William Kingston, she'd expected to be dead by noon? Is it the 18th of May? And he tells her, actually, we've had to delay your execution to the 19th of May. She's prepared herself. That's it. For me, that is, she's just accepted her fate. She's in so much shock and probably fear that she's gone into collapse.
No, I agree. On the 19th of May, Anne is walking to her execution. She's dead by 9 o'clock in the morning. And I thought you could talk a little bit about the fact you said how serene she looked and your theory behind that.
Yeah, so Lancelot du Carle says the Queen has never looked so beautiful. So when we go into a collapse, again, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm not a psychologist, I'm in no way trying to diagnose Anne here, but I believe the body really releases like its own natural pain killers to sort of calm us down, like our own natural sort of dopamines, good hormones to sort of, you know, chill us out. A bit like after childbirth, you get that rush of love that makes you forget how traumatic and painful childbirth is. So when you go into total collapse, your body releases like our own natural opioid to protect us. And I think this is what's happening with Anne here. I think she's gone into complete collapse, and this sort of look about her is because she's just accepted her fate. She knows there's not going to be a last minute. I think she knows in her heart of hearts there's not going to be a last minute reprieve. And I think she's just accepted it, and she's gone into complete shock, really. She's gone into complete collapse, because who would have thought the man who had torn apart the European stage of royalty, the institution of the Catholic Church, and his first marriage to a very powerful woman from a very powerful family, just to marry you only for 3 years later to execute you in the tower. It's unthinkable. But I think she knew we'd probably gone that far, and there was no backing out of it, because he'd gone that far to marry her. So why wouldn't he go that far to get rid of her? And I think she just, this was it, and she just accepted it. But, you know, in her speech, she sort of thanks him. And that is to protect Elizabeth, ultimately.
No, I agree. I think in the end, Anne accepted her fate and didn't want to be her usual self, where she says something witty or barbed. She wanted to make sure Elizabeth would be okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Anne had, I mean, this is the what-if train here, because we ultimately never know, and Tudors did not have the understanding of mental health like we do. But if Anne had managed to go to a nunnery and been given some sort of sense of routine without all the fanfare and the splendour and the viper's pit that was the Tudor court, Anne might have been able to have been given the space to allow herself to get into a state of regulated emotions rather than this chronic stress that I suspect, again, it's a theory, somebody might prove me completely wrong, but I suspect Anne was under chronic stress. And I think if she'd have been sent to a nunnery and given that breathing space and got into a quiet routine, I think there might have been a little bit of space for Anne to potentially get well.
Yes, no, I agree. I think if she had a breather at the court, she might have felt the benefit, as you see in 1526 to 1527, when she's less at court because she needs a breather.
Yeah, absolutely. If she'd been given, if she was allowed to just retire to a nunnery, she might have been given the breathing space to form a little bit of emotional stability.
No, I agree. Thank you for coming on today. I've really enjoyed our chat.
Thanks, Jess. Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. Honestly, thank you for having me.
But I'd like to ask my 5 fun Tudor questions to kind of lighten the mood if we've talked about anything serious. Have you got a Tudor pet peeve?
Wait, so Tudor pet peeve, do you mean like historical fact? Because I think the biggest one is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers playing Henry VIII, I think, especially old Henry. I can't get away with it.
No, I agree. I find it quite infuriating that he refused to wear a fat suit.
Why? And then the old man voice at the end, I just couldn't be done with it, Jess.
Have you got a favourite historical building?
Probably the Tower of London. I think for me, the Tower has seen so much, and it's housed so many important people, and it's a lot, there's a lot of sadness at the Tower as well. Also, it's got a little bit of myth and legend around it, hasn't it, with the Ravens. If the Ravens ever leave, then the UK will sink. But I like the Tower of London.
It's one of my favourites. I love the Tower so much. I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but have you got a favourite history film?
Yes, so actually, this answer might surprise you, because I can't say The Other Bling Girl, really, can I? Because actually, the answer to your next question, that is one of my favourite books, The Other Bling Girl. I think it's brilliantly written. I think Anne is portrayed as a little bit catty in there and a little bit of a bitch, and I quite enjoy that portrayal of her. But actually, my favourite film is probably Elizabeth I, The Golden Age, where Cate Blanchett plays Elizabeth. It's that where she rails at the Spanish ambassador. I too can command the wind. But shivers up me, Cate Blanchett's so powerful in that. It really, for me, that is Elizabeth when she's described as having her father's temper. And I think Cate really conveys that quite well.
So you said your favourite book is The Other Bling Girl by Philippa Gregory.
Yes.
Have you got a favourite non-fiction book?
So I think I'm going to have to join you on this one. I think it's got to be Tracy Borman, Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, The Mother and Daughter Who Changed History. It's, again, Tracy sort of talks about the aspects of emotional well-being within her book. And there's certain, I bought it when I was in Australia last year. I saw it in, is it called Borders, the Australian bookshop? $34. And I said to my cousin, I was, oh my God, there it is. So I grabbed it off the shelf. So I'd been looking forward to its release date. And I remember crying on the plane home, reading certain parts of it.
No, it's an utterly fantastic book. I can't recommend it enough. It is utterly brilliant. Finally, have you got a favourite history fact?
Favourite history fact. Actually, I think I do, and I think I wrote it down. I didn't write it down. Oh, no. Actually, yes, I do have a favourite history fact. So, where I am sat right now is a little place in the world called the Headland, and it was a Spanish Armada lookout for Elizabeth I, and it's my family home, and I absolutely love it. We were a little seaside town, and we were a lookout for Elizabeth I during the Spanish Armada.
That's really interesting. What a cool fact.
Yeah, I do. I love it. It's very historical.
It is indeed. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope our listeners have gained some insight into how to reevaluate these historical figures with maybe a bit more empathy than they are tended to give.
Yeah. Hopefully. Thank you for having me, Jess.
It's my pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode and you loved all the others, please take the time to rate and review the show.